How do we, as a society, as communities, protect women from being killed by violent men? Professor Heather Douglas researches legal responses to domestic and family violence. She's from the University of Melbourne Law School. Professor Douglas, great to have you on the program.
Thanks very much.
And Jess Hill is a journalist and educator on coercive control. Jess, great to have you back.
Hi, Ellie. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Jess, every time a woman is murdered and we see op-eds talking about needing to work harder on respectful relationships and gendered attitudes. Now, you argue that those conversations alone won't stop gendered violence in Australia. Why not?
Well, I think we really have to think about some of the things that we've been hearing, particularly in the last few weeks, from leaders and prevention agencies, which goes along the lines of, we just need to be having better conversations, you know, fathers need to have better conversations with their sons and so on. And that is really fundamental to our prevention efforts. But what I think that ignores is the fact that actually so many sons across Australia are growing up with fathers who use coercive control against them and their siblings and their mothers. They wake up every day and watch their fathers degrade and manipulate their mothers. They're watching him be violent to her, and they see him get away with it. And adolescents are also seeing their friends get away with it, because we know that one in three young people aged 18 to 19 have experienced intimate partner violence in a relationship. And I think, you know, we've made awareness campaigns and education and conversations the central plank of our prevention strategy for the past decade. It's not showing results. We're not even seeing significant improvements to community attitudes. And in the meantime, abusers are still remaining largely out of sight. They're allowed to run systematic campaigns of degradation and terror, both against their partners in the home and through our systems that enable them. And as we're seeing, they're increasingly committing acts that escalate to murder.
So when you say systems, Jess, are you talking about things like child support systems where they have, you know, some form of contact with their former partner, the courts, things like that?
Yes, family law systems, practically any system really that can be leveraged. Child protection agencies are also leveraged. We see a lot of false reports of neglect, for example, being made by perpetrators. We see perpetrators calling police and suggesting they do welfare checks on their ex-partners, which is a form of harassment. I mean, that just the list goes on and on. And a lot of the time we're seeing abusers just act with total impunity, particularly in their systems abuse. But as we've seen in the alleged murders recently, also through the courts, even when they have serious charges of very serious violence, sexual violence, and things that are obviously risk factors for future homicide.
So, Jess, the raw numbers are disturbing, but we heard earlier on RN Breakfast today, the Australian Institute of Criminology pointed out that the rate of intimate partner homicide against women is on a long downward trend. Last year's was the third lowest rate in over 30 years. Should we take heart from that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, murder generally across Australia has been on a downward trend over time. Now, when you look to academic explanations for why that downward trend is, there's a paper by Walter Forrest that looks at this, and it says that essentially we can't really pin that to increases in gender equality or the sorts of things that prevention agencies would pin a downward trend to. Really, the sorts of things that have changed and been correlated with that are things like gun reform laws, are things like the socioeconomic conditions, even down to just the population rates, the number of young men in the society. There's so many different macro factors that go into homicide rates that, to be honest and to be fair to the government, there's actually not a lot they can do necessarily to drive the homicide rate down in the short term. What we do need to look at when we look at homicides, and why looking at, for example, the alleged murder of Molly Ticehurst and the failings there is so important, is to look at what are the preventable homicides amongst those? Where was the systems failure? And how do we make the people who were invisible until they committed homicide, the fixated coercive controllers, how do we make them visible before they commit that act?
We're speaking with Jess Hill, who's a journalist and educator on coercive control, and Professor Heather Douglas, who researches legal responses to domestic and family violence at the University of Melbourne Law School. Heather, when we look at the policing side of things, do we need more or different laws, or is it about the way the ones we've got are being used?
I think it's largely about better implementation of the laws that we've currently got in place. I think too often we see gaps and people falling through those gaps because police drop the ball in one way or another. We now have a lot of information about risk assessment, and we know that risk is dynamic. And too often we see police officers relying on a previous risk assessment done a few weeks ago by another police officer and just importing that into today's risk assessment, for example. Really dangerous kind of practices such as that. I think we also see police being too much influenced by the rational perpetrator that they meet at the scene, whereas they're confronted by a woman who's often really distressed, perhaps out of control, she's been abused, she's not making sense. And there's a tendency to listen to the person who sounds the most rational. So I think that's a real concern as well.
So is that about resourcing for police or education of police?
I think it's about education to some extent of police. And we know that education does work for police, but we need to keep coming back to it. It's not enough to just educate police once off at the police academy. They actually have to come back and do it pretty much every 8 months or so. That's what the research is telling us. And that's high resource. But we do need to think about how we do that better. So I think that's an important aspect as well. But I think it's also about how magistrates are managing these issues. I think too often they're not asking for the evidence that they need to back up the claims that are being made by perpetrators in their courts. Often the women aren't there when the matters go to courts. So there's a turn to the perpetrator's view of events, and there's too much trust placed in that. Just the other day I went to court, for example, and a perpetrator turned up to court. He'd been sentenced a couple of months before for serious breaches of a Domestic Violence Protection Act, protection order, and he'd been told that he had to stay away from the woman, under probation, attend counselling. He turned up to court to say, well, I don't want to attend counselling because I'm very busy at work, got a lot on. And the magistrate actually changed the sentencing order to say you don't have to attend counselling. There was a possibility there for intervention in that man's behaviour, and his view of his situation was just accepted by the magistrate without any evidence, and off he went on his day. So I think we need to keep, as Jess says, keep perpetrators in view, take our responsibility really seriously every time we're having an opportunity to intervene with a perpetrator, and getting evidence to back up what they say. I think too often we accept it at face value, and I think that's really dangerous.
A couple of texts coming in. Women-only police stations where women feel safe talking to women officers and social workers and counsellors, says V in Northern Queensland. Sue in Queanbeyan writes, I've recently helped a woman with two very small children escape DV. She had to go into hiding for 3 weeks after getting a family violence order, as amazingly, it took that long for the perpetrator to be served by ACT police. This was despite almost daily queries from friends to the police urging for it to be served. We're speaking with Professor Heather Douglas from the University of Melbourne Law School and Jess Hill, journalist and educator on coercive control, on really what they've seen as the evidence-based interventions that can work at various different points in the process of these incidents. And Heather, you've researched what happens when victims of violence use the courts to try and stay safe and, you know, find safety for themselves and their children. They reported some negative, some positive experiences. Was there useful things that came out of that research in terms of ways forward?
For sure, I think. There are good experiences of court, but obviously we hear about the bad experiences, and we're focused on continuous improvement, and we should be. And so I think knowing what goes wrong and why it goes wrong is really important, so we continue to improve. I think there's diversity amongst magistrates. There's diversity amongst attitudes in magistrates and judges in our systems. So women can get lucky, and perpetrators or people who perpetrate violence can get lucky about the kinds of magistrates they confront in the court. And that's not good. We don't have consistent responses in the courts. I think it's a good response when it is taken seriously, where evidence is produced, where the parties are treated neutrally, where the magistrate, women have told me that they when a magistrate actually treats the process as neutral, don't appear to align with their perpetrator partner, which often happens. I've heard it in courts where a magistrate might say something like, look, mate, I know how you feel, but which really sounds like, from a victim survivor's point of view, that there's a bit of alignment going on. And that language probably impacts on the behaviour and the attitudes of the magistrate using that language as well. So really to maintain that neutrality of the court process and look at the evidence that's in front of us is really important. And making sure that evidence is there, all the way back to Rosie Baddig's experience and the issues with bail in relation to her partner. We didn't have the evidence and the magistrate didn't ask for it. So that's really important always to be saying, well, where's the evidence for this? What are the risk factors? What am I dealing with here? And I think that was the same story in New South Wales with the bail that was granted for a person who'd recently been charged with rape. Really, there were high risk factors in that case. And it's really quite surprising to me that that person was granted bail. So what was the evidence that suggested that that person was low risk in terms of grants of bail? So I really think keeping our eye on the ball constantly is really important. And I think magistrates and police are dealing with these issues so frequently and so often. And most people don't die. Most people don't appear to get seriously injured. But that doesn't mean every single time they're dealing with a family violence matter, they shouldn't take it very seriously. They shouldn't look at their risk factors and they shouldn't try to put material things in place to try to make sure that person is safe. That might mean referrals to Men's Behaviour Change. It might mean referrals to refuge support for the victim survivors, various other interventions that we might think about. So I think being continuous in the way we respond to this is really important. And we can imagine the fatigue that a lot of these service providers feel. They've seen it all before. Here it is again. Nothing happened last time. She didn't leave. But it happens again, and they've still got to be there. They've still got to be thinking about all these things really seriously and really carefully.
Text messages. Dave says, I think magistrates need continuing development. Don't just blame the police. And Joe in Sydney says, judges are incredibly naive about coercive control dynamics. The legal system is biased against victims. Heather, I know you've been working on a bench book, a resource for magistrates around these issues. What kinds of information does that aim to bring to their attention that might help them, you know, take those approaches you've outlined?
Yeah, well, I'm actually talking to magistrates in Western Australia on Friday, and I think Jess is going to be part of that as well. And we're talking about the bench book on Friday. And what we try to bring to magistrates is the best practices that we see, the best approaches that are available given the legislation that they're dealing with. And I mean, I think that's something that we really need to be thinking about in Australia is we have this diversity of approaches to family violence across the country. So not only is every different state and territory dealing with domestic and family violence slightly differently, so are we within states with different pieces of legislation dealing with domestic and family violence differently. So as much as I would like to promote a consistent treatment of domestic and family violence across the country, we do know a lot about what the best practices are and what the best risk assessment approaches are and so on. There are different legislative approaches in each jurisdiction, and magistrates and police are limited by those pieces of legislation. So we do try as far as we can to promote those best practices, but there are limits with legislation.
As there are everywhere. Professor Heather Douglas is who you're hearing from the University of Melbourne Law School, and Jess Hill is with us too, who's written extensively on coercive control and domestic and family violence. She's the journalist and educator. Jess, you've been working with criminologist Michael Salter on a white paper called Rethinking Primary Prevention. And I understand that those accountability and consequences issues that you mentioned earlier are a big part of that, having consequences flow from if you are using the banking system or the child support system to harass or intimidate people. What else is coming out of that for you that you think are key planks of what should be our approach?
Well, essentially, we just want governments and prevention agencies to take a much wider and more practical view of what prevention looks like. And I think we can't just be focused on a whole of population strategy where we just, you know, where we really lean into social awareness campaigns and education campaigns to try to change culture. I think we need to look at the practical ways that we can stop violence, not just from, you know, boys and young men, stopping them from becoming violent at all, but stopping people already using violence from using violence again. And so the four missing pieces that we've identified that we think really needs to be focused on, and we hope National Cabinet will focus on this on Wednesday, as you say, accountability. You know, accountability is prevention. Deterrence are prevention. If we see, if perpetrators see that they can just continue to perpetrate with impunity, then that's what they do. And that is the message that their children receive as well. We also think recovery is prevention. And the National Recovery Alliance really put this up in lights a couple of years ago, because we have seen for so long the intergenerational cycles of violence. And yet, the sector that works on preventing child abuse and neglect and the domestic family violence sector are actually quite separate. There's not a lot of connections between the two. So we want to really see that change, because we need to link up the work that's being done to prevent child abuse, the work that's being done to prevent violence against women, and the healing from that trauma and abuse. It all needs to be linked. And we have to properly resource the front line to work with child survivors so they can properly heal.
We're looking at really practical structural changes that would help women who were trying to leave, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's practical structural changes in terms of, like, one of the things that we think in terms of actual practical structural gender equality changes are things like the restoration of the single parenting payment, which the government did, raising it up from single parents with children up to age 8, now up to age 14, which is still shy of 16, which is where it was under Whitlam. So, you know, not great that we've gone backwards since the 70s, but anyway. But in terms of leaving, and knowing that you are not just going to be condemning your children to, you know, years of living in poverty, because 60% of single mothers in this country are survivors of domestic violence, 50% of them are living in poverty with their children. So the choice, as Anne Summers put it so brilliantly in her paper a couple of years ago, the choice that so many victim survivors have when they're leaving is, do I stay with the violence and the coercive control, or do I choose poverty? And that's just unacceptable, I think, you know, in a society as sophisticated as ours, with, you know, absolutely, you know, blessed with an improved economy. We're probably going to see a surplus in this year's budget. It's just not okay that is still a choice for so many women and kids in this country. But we also need to look at regulation. And I just want to really quickly make this point, is that in our current primary prevention approaches, we really see talk about the private sector as being predominantly engaged in terms of how can we educate and train them so that we create safe, respectful workplaces, and so on. And that's really important. And it's the fundamental work of respect at work as well, and stopping sexual harassment and other things. But there's almost no mention of the business models that are actually profiting from and exacerbating gendered violence. And we really want to see violence prevention frameworks and governments tackle wealthy industries that are profiting from violence against women, like online pornography, the technology sector, the multi-billion dollar alcohol and gambling industries, because we know the intersections between those industries and violence and coercive control are so strong, but they don't get talked about because we're so concerned about, for example, the old narrative that, well, you know, all these abusive men, they're just drunks. So we sort of stopped talking about alcohol, you know, and we don't like to think that there's one causal factor outside of the gender inequality framework. We don't like to say, well, the problem gambling caused the violence. Now, of course, none of these things cause the violence on their own. But if they are exacerbating it, if they are making it more complex, and if we're seeing online porn just normalizing gendered aggression for teenage boys and girls, then we need to be really serious about what we can do to step in and stop that, instead of just feeling like we have no choice and we just have to float along with history and be carried away by the tide.
Heather, you argue that porn has led to changes in the types of violence being perpetrated. And I know you've worked on some, you've helped implement laws in Queensland around non-fatal strangulation. Tell us about that link and why it's important to look at.
Yeah, look, I really agree with Jess's points. I think that if we're going to have a serious conversation about domestic and family violence, I think we need to think about misogyny and the kinds of big corporate entities that are promoting misogyny. And I think that maybe around the table normally for law reform around domestic violence, we might have family lawyers, criminal lawyers, DV lawyers generally. But I think we need the corporate lawyers in there as well to look at how do we regulate pornography to make sure it's not promoting misogyny. Now, there's all sorts of issues about censorship and so on. And obviously, pornography, many people may think it's not all bad and so on. So, I mean, censorship is another question, but I think regulating pornography is something we really need to think hard about, how we do that well, and similarly with online platforms and so on. Some of the things that are promoted in pornography, for example, are strangulation during sex, rape fantasies and so on. It normalises these kinds of really misogynistic behaviours, and we know that kids as young as 10 are watching pornography. It's very available on their phones. It's free. And there are numerous sites that they can go to and simply search for whatever they want to search for. So it's very accessible and people are getting to it very young. People that I'm supervising in PhDs are saying that some of the people they're interviewing are learning about how to have sexual relationships on the basis of pornography. So that sets up a whole system of relating to each other, which is based on these misogynistic tropes, which is incredibly concerning. I think we also shouldn't drop the ball on things like alcohol and drug support, because as Jess says, we know they don't cause violence, but they certainly exacerbate it and make the harms much more serious and much more common. So I think thinking about how we support people to access those programs is really important, and how we regulate alcohol is also really important. It's ubiquitous in various contexts, television and so on, that we see all the time. So I think we need to think about that as well. So yeah, very important. And strangulation, obviously, we have started to deal with that, I think, and we criminalised it in every state and territory now. It's yet to come into line in Victoria, but it will soon. And I think that's important because it basically sends a message that this is really dangerous and risky behaviour. We know that someone who's been strangled is 7 times more likely to be killed in the following weeks and months. And so the risk is that, you know, that will happen even if it wasn't intended that that should be the outcome. And we know that it takes as much as opening a can of Coke, the pressure, to actually cause death. So it's a very low level of pressure. We also know that people who use strangulation during sex do experience brain injury after 3 or 4 occasions of using strangulation during sex. You know, there's limitations on their problem solving and cognitive understanding. So we know that it's a very dangerous behaviour.
As many of the behaviours we've been discussing today are, look, it's a really difficult thing to talk about, and I know you are both in great demand to talk about it today. Thank you both so much for your time on Life Matters today.
Thanks very much, Hilary.
Thank you.
Professor Heather Douglas there researches legal responses to domestic and family violence at the University of Melbourne Law School. And Jess Hill is a journalist and educator on coercive control.
Getting in touch with ABC RN is easy. Join the conversation live using the ABC Listen app's call and text features.